Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is Tuesday, June 22nd, 2004. Today's session number is ROB 2004-02. Today's speaker is Barbara Rossing. The lesson for today is The Bible and the Bestsellers, Lamb Power and Nonviolence.
Second in a little series this week that I'm calling The Bible and the Best Sellers. These first 3 days, we're looking at the Left Behind novels, this 60 million and plus bestseller that the 12th and supposedly final one, although now there's going to be a sequel and a prequel. The 12th one was released on March 30th called The Glorious Appearing. And I wrote a book called The Rapture Exposed in response to these novels that I don't know if it's sold out again in the bookstore, but there is another shipment coming in later this week, so just hold on, and I think they're coming in probably Wednesday. But what I want to look at today is probably what I've most been looking forward to talking with you about at Holden Village, which is the question of violence and nonviolence, and what I call lamb power. Because to me, this is probably the most troubling aspect of Left Behind theology and of these novels. Tomorrow, I want to talk with you about the political aspects, which are really scary in the sense that I think this theology is really taking over in the, in some ways at least, in the politics of our country. But first of all, I think we have to ask the question that's really at the heart of the issue, which is, who is Jesus? And what is Jesus' vision for how transformation happens in the world, and what is the heart of the Bible and the heart of the message of Jesus. You saw yesterday, those of you who were here, I showed that little clip from 60 Minutes, too, that I was on briefly, but it was mainly about the Left Behind novels and authors Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins. And the line that I want to pick up on today is where Tim LaHaye said, liberals have constructed this loving, wimpy Jesus who would never judge anyone. And they're then offering a corrective to what they see as the loving, wimpy Jesus, which is this more avenging warrior Jesus. I don't know how many of you saw in the New York Times, I think it was the first week of April, there was an editorial by David Kirkpatrick called the Return of the Avenging Warrior Jesus. And it was looking at the way our images of Jesus have changed over the years. You know, that famous picture by, I think, is it Warner Salmon, is that his name? You know, that Jesus with the long brown hair that many of us saw in our Sunday school classrooms. You know, this sort of gentle, wimpy Jesus. I mean, let's admit it, that Jesus looks wimpy. And then how now with Promise Keepers and certainly with the Left Behind novels well, I would say we have competing images of Jesus right now that we need to think about as Christians. But this sort of tough guy, I even call him the Terminator Jesus, that has returned with a vengeance now in this new millennium is the image of Jesus in the Left Behind novels. And I think we really need to counter that. Now, I will say that I think why it's tough to be a Christian, a biblical-based Christian, is that, to be honest, there are multiple images of Jesus and of God in the Bible. And every strand of of what you see right now, the faces of Christianity, can claim a biblical basis. I mean, they are all there. So all we can do is simply, in our discourse, try to be more persuasive about which images are central to the Bible and which version of Jesus is more the heart of the biblical witness. But obviously that's precisely where the debate is. But I don't want to say that they've made up their avenging warrior Jesus. That Jesus is certainly there. But what I do want to argue, especially now as we turn to the book of Revelation, is that even though many of us have the impression that the book of Revelation is violent and vengeful and scary, and a lot of you have heard me do stuff up here on Revelation before, so some of this will be a repeat, but I guess I've never been so convinced that we need to self-consciously look to the book of Revelation and even there make the argument that the image of Jesus is nonviolent and gives us a different vision of power in our world today, a vision of Lamb power. That word, actually, I didn't coin it, but I'm using it all the time now. In fact, I don't know if Janet or Diana's here, but I think this could be an idea for Holden's summer theme next summer or sometime. I mean, that is so urgent in our world right now that we teach a different way, that I'd love to see Lamb power t-shirts. I was talking to my sister, actually, who's an artist in Northfield, Minnesota. You know, what would Lamb power look like? Well, let's talk about it later today, you know, because she had an image of this little lamb, you know, flexing his muscles. What we need to figure out is how to be winsome and visionary, and how to help people imagine and envision a different model of power in our world that's not the power of military violence and greater firepower, which is how God's kingdom triumphs in the Left Behind house. I mean, the Christians there have better computers, they have better satellite phones, they have better encryption devices, they have better weapons, directed energy weapons. They win in those novels by having more high tech and being able to outsmart the Antichrist with better weaponry. And I don't think that's the vision of the Bible. But I certainly want to talk about it with you here today. There's no place like Holden to take up a topic like this. And I feel like we all have to go back to school together, back to what we were doing in the 80s up here with looking at John Howard Yoder's book, The Politics of Jesus. Now we need to relearn the whole issue of violence and nonviolence in an increasingly violent and frightening world. And I'll say, for those who haven't seen, I was delighted to see over on the back wall of the Village Center, there's a list of names, at least up through the month of May, of all the people who have been killed in the Iraq War, Iraqis that we know the names of, and Americans as well, because the number of people killed in our world is terrifying. And to the extent that this is in any way being done in the name of the Bible, I really think we need to look at this issue of who is Jesus, and what is the Bible's vision of power for our world? Okay, yesterday, in looking at where Left Behind theology comes from, we looked first at the book of Daniel, because this is where they get the structure of their what they say is God's plan for the end of the world, that God lays out, in their view, in the book of Daniel, a literal prediction of a sequence of events that must happen over the course of 490 years, the 70 weeks of years, in this very obscure passage, Daniel 9, 25 to 27. They say that the first 7 times 7? Yeah, 49. 490. Okay, they say that the first 483 of these years happened, leading up to the time of Jesus, and then that God paused the prophetic stopwatch, because the Jews didn't accept Jesus as the political Messiah that they should have. And so the whole world has been living on pause for the last 2,000 years. But that any minute now, God can resume the prophetic countdown, the prophetic stopwatch, for these last, what they say, will be 7 years of great violence and tribulation inflicted by God upon the earth. And they say that the book of Revelation spells out in detail what must happen over the course of these 7 years. So we need to turn to Revelation today, because I think this is where the rubber really meets the road in terms of the question of violence or nonviolence as being what Jesus is about. Most people it's hard to discount the fact that in the Gospels, for example, Jesus says, "Blessed are the peacemakers." Or, when the Garden of Gethsemane, when Peter takes out his sword and wants to cut off the Roman soldier's ear, Jesus says, "No, put away your sword. Those who take up the sword will perish by the sword." I mean, you could certainly, even in the Gospels, find passages where Jesus sounds more violent. The probably most famous would be, in the temple when Jesus goes in and overturns the tables and, takes the cord of whips and stuff. I mean, the whip of cords, sorry. You can find passages where Jesus is very confrontational, and you could say even violent in the Gospels, but it's tougher. But what the Left Behind proponents, or fundamentalists, whatever you want to call them, will argue is what I heard in an interview on National Public Radio a year ago, March. Is that right? Yeah, leading up to the Iraq War. I was writing this book. I was living in Wenatchee. and an NPR interview. I might as well quote it out of here. This is the chapter on nonviolence, but the interviewer was talking to a fundamentalist Christian who enlisted the Book of Revelation as support for war in Iraq. True, the interviewee acknowledged, Jesus preached a gospel of peace. So he acknowledged that the Jesus of the Gospels is a peace-loving Jesus. But in this person's view, the Gospel's portrait of a peaceful Jesus is trumped by the more violent Jesus of Revelation. Here's the quote. The same suffering Messiah of the Gospels is also, in the book of Revelation, going to be the conquering Messiah. Just read Revelation. And so that's what I decided to do. The next time I did a Bible study with a group, and this was then at the People's Seminary in Burlington, Washington. I don't know how many of you have heard Bob Ekblad from up here. He runs this thing called Tierra Nuevo and also the People's Seminary. I was going there the next weekend, and I thought, okay, you know, this is obviously at the heart of the question, because people are using this idea of a conquering Messiah Jesus in the book of Revelation to justify war and to say that this, you know, yeah, you've got these different images of Jesus, but this one trumps everything. And indeed, in the book of Revelation, you have Jesus in chapter 19, and this is the famous passage now that is the centerpiece of the 12th and last Left Behind novel called The Glorious Appearing. This is where Jesus comes back on a white horse with a sword coming out of his mouth, and he slays his enemies with the sword of his mouth. And this is most people's impression of the Jesus of the book of Revelation, is this avenging warrior Jesus. I also heard, you know, more of even a left-wing person saying the same thing about the book of Revelation, a scholar named Karen Armstrong. She's written a number of books, History of God, let's see, where's one of you? She's great. But I heard her a few weeks ago on Krista Tippett's program on Public Radio. I don't know how many of you ever listened to it, Speaking of Faith. It's a great show. It's really, really wonderful. A few months earlier, Miroslav Volf had been on there talking about violence. But anyway, even she said, yeah, the problem with the book of Revelation is that Jesus is this violent, conquering Jesus. And this is very much a problematic Jesus in our world today. Now, I agree with her that that's a problematic Jesus. But I guess where I disagree is I don't think that's the heart of the image of Jesus in the book of Revelation. But that's what I want to look at with you today, is how do you answer people who say that the book of Revelation is all about a conquering Jesus, and the way he conquers is by slaying his enemies and killing people. Because in these Left Behind novels, the dominant theme is extensive bloodshed. I mean, it's just unbelievable the level of violence. I think, you know, they're thrilling novels, and you can read them because they're a fast read and they're fun and stuff like that, but you have to have a stomach for violence. It's unbelievable how many people are killed in the name of God. I read a review by a woman with Publishers Weekly named Jana Rice. You might have heard her on Talk of the Nation about a month or so ago, talking about these novels. And she said, this is a great quote, never have so many ways been found to slaughter innocent people in the name of Jesus. But the idea is that violence sells. I mean, she's unabashed in saying this is why these novels sell so much, is people like violence. But I think that's precisely the problem, and that we as Christians have to look violence right in the face and say this is wrong. In the ancient world, already this was an issue for Christians. It's nothing new. I mean, this has always been a question for Christians. You know, pre-TV, pre-movies, the place you went to get entertainment was the amphitheaters. Those of you who have seen the movie Gladiator know what that was like. That for pleasure and entertainment, people would go by the thousands into the arenas all over. I mean, the biggest amphitheater is the Colosseum in Rome. But all around the Roman Empire at this time, late first century and through the second century. Gladiator is set at the end of the second century during the reign of Marcus Aurelius. But for the last 100 years, one of the major forms of entertainment had been going to the arenas to watch animals and people kill each other and get killed, and that this was entertainment. And already in the second century, you've got an important theologian named Tertullian, who wrote a treatise called De Spectaculis, called Spectacles, basically, is what it is, and how even though it's attractive and thrilling and exciting to go to the spectacle and watch violence, that this is really dangerous for Christians because it's addictive. You can get drawn in by watching violence. And early Christians, everyone knew how addictive and how enticing this can be. And Tertullian said Christians must not go to the arenas, to the amphitheaters, to watch people getting killed and watch animals getting killed. This is not Christian entertainment. So obviously, you know, we face some of the same issues today as well. Especially, with, I would say, with the interface between, you know, video games and... there was a review in Christian Century a month or so ago about how video games have become so much more violent now. And you, when kids, you know, or whoever uses them, when you kill people, I mean, there's blood that splatters and stuff. I mean, it's very, very graphic, and it's thrilling, but dangerous, I think. And we really need to really look at the issue of violence. Okay, so my question for today is, who is Jesus in the book of Revelation? What's the primary image of Jesus, the heart of the image of Jesus in Revelation, which I'm going to argue is lamb power. And then I want to leave more time for discussion today. I apologize that I took so much time yesterday, but how can we then be about lamb power in our world? How can we offer this transformative vision as the understanding of the heart of who Jesus is? All right, the tool that I used with these people in Burlington, Washington, that I will recommend to you also, and that I'm telling my students all the time, is the most important book they can own. It's called A Concordance. This is one in the Holden Library, this old beat-up one called The Englishman's Greek Concordance. Because the problem with, I mean, first of all, I'll say to all of you, if you have time on your hands, learn Greek. Or at least just a little bit, just the alphabet and a little bit, you know, go to your local seminary, whatever. I think you'll find a time well spent. Because, as you know, the New Testament is written in Greek, and I've done this up here at Holden with a number of words. The problem is that some of the most juicy or richest Greek words in the New Testament are difficult to translate. My favorite example of that is koinonia. I think this is the best word in the whole New Testament, but it's going to be translated about 8 or 10 different ways. Sharing, communion, community,
fellowship,
giving. So you can't, as an English reader, look up koinonia in an English concordance. You have to look it up in a Greek concordance to find all the references to it. And same way with this question of conquering in the book of Revelation. Unfortunately, I don't want to get you feeling intimidated. I mean, I'll help you with a concordance if you ever want to do this. Or you can just get an English-Greek concordance like this one. When I go to my doctoral seminars, then I bring my big Greek-Greek concordance. But when I go to just my regular classes, I bring the English-Greek concordance. That you simply look up the word in Greek, but then all the references to it are English. Because, you know, I mean, English is our language, for God's sake. So. But anyway, the word in Greek for conquer, interestingly, is the Greek word Nike. It's very, very interesting. It's the verb, this is the noun, Nike, and the verb is Nikao, which means I conquer. And this is really interesting in our culture. Because, you know, Nike tennis shoes are named after the Greek goddess, who we know to be this flying goddess, you know, that looks like angels. But in fact, it's the flying goddess of military victory. It's the goddess of victory. And victory for the Roman Empire meant military victory. And it's amazing. As I was researching this and going into archaeological stuff, I don't know, how many of you have been to Rome? Have some of you? Okay, oh, good. All right, remember seeing the Arch of Titus? You know, if you go to the Roman Forum, there's a bunch of different arches. But any of the arches, the Arch of Septimius Severus or the Arch of... who's that other arch? Is there an Arch of Constantine?
Constantine.
Okay, the Arch of Titus, though, is a particular example of the it was celebrating the reconquest of Palestine in the year 70. I mean, basically, these arches are propaganda. That's what they fundamentally are, is military propaganda. When Rome won another military victory, they would put up an arch to advertise it. You know, because they didn't have radio, they didn't have TV. Put up an arch. And on the Arch of Titus, this is celebrating the defeat, you know, because in Palestine in 67 AD, the Israelites or Jews managed to overthrow Roman rule for about 3 years. Amazingly, this was the only successful revolt against Rome that ever had that much success. But then Titus came in, who later became emperor, and over the course of 3 years fought the Jewish war and managed to put down this revolt or rebellion and enslave the rebellious leaders of this thing, kill many, many people. They had this huge victory procession. They actually had victory processions all around the empire to show off the captives. I mean, there's nothing more effective to telling provinces that are thinking about rebelling that, you know, it's useless, don't even think about it, than to parade through town. I mean, you know, we've got the Holden 4th of July parade and stuff, but these are parades where you have chained captives and you're dragging them through town and showing off to the other foreign provinces what it looks like if you try to rebel. And the victory processions then culminated with taking these captives to Rome in chains as slaves. Many were then sold as slaves. I mean, this is how the slave trade was fed in the Roman Empire, was by enslaving more provinces and conquering. And many were killed that day on the big victory procession. And all of this then is enshrined on the Arch of Titus. So you have this very poignant scene of the temple vessels from the temple in Jerusalem being carried captive through Rome, and people then with their hands behind their backs being dragged behind that. And then all over the arch on the top part are what look like flying angels, but they're actually flying Nikes. They're flying victory goddesses. And this was Rome's propaganda on coins as well. The symbol of Nike was their most potent symbol, and this was the symbol of military conquest and military victory. And what Rome was saying very effectively with its money, with its everything that it put out, its sculptures that are so beautiful in a sense, but they're also very intimidating, is to say, you know, any effort at resistance is futile. Don't even bother to revolt. Rome is the be-all and end-all. We are the ruler of the world forever and ever. And their slogan was Roma Eterna. Rome would be eternal. And their goddess that ensured all this was Nike, the goddess of military victory. Okay, so it's very significant, I think, then, that Nike is one of the central words in the book of Revelation. Because I think what Revelation is giving us is a pretty subversive theology of a different model of victory that is looking Rome right in the face and standing up to this incredible empire and saying, you think you're all-powerful, all-conquering, you know, you think you have Nike, let me show you what true Nike is. And then it shows us, you know, lamb power. but the book of Revelation thinks this is persuasive. I mean, it's rather remarkable to think that this little author writing in this little island of Patmos off the coast of Asia Minor, knowing full well that as far as you could travel, I mean, thousands of miles in any direction, was all Rome. There's never been an empire like Rome, except, you know, maybe now the United States is taking up that mantle and saying, you know, what's it like to be an empire? Okay, but I mean, Rome was amazingly hegemonic. And yet John sits there on Patmos and has this vision of Nike, of conquering, that is radically different from what Rome is serving up on these coins, on these arches. And it wasn't just the Arch of Titus from Rome. I mean, how many of you have been to Ephesus in Turkey? Some of you have, right? Okay, there too. And we know that John had lived there. Okay, there too. Everywhere you go down the street, I mean, there are these beautiful little what look like angels. And then you realize, no, these are Nikes. These are Rome's flying military goddess everywhere, reminding people of how victory really happens. And John looks at those Nikes and says, no, that's not what true Nike is about. That's not what true conquering is about. Rather, what we learn from God and from Jesus is a different model of conquering. And that's what then he takes us through. He leads us through in the book of Revelation. And here are the references. Let's see, I can count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16. I think I got them all. I got them out of this Englishman's Greek Concordance this morning. 17 references to Nike, where he shows us then a different theology of Nike. It's not Roman military victory Nike. It's the victory of God's nonviolent Lamb who unexpectedly teaches us and gives us a different way. All right, the first 7 references to Nike in the book of Revelation are in chapters 2 and 3. And these are in the 7 letters to the 7 churches. You know how that book starts out with this description of Jesus. And then in chapters 2 and 3, you get these letters to these 7 churches. So the church that is in Ephesus And, all right, Dan's got his map of Turkey here. I'm going to attempt a map of Asia Minor. How's that? All right, here it is. All right. Okay. But anyway, the seven cities in Revelation are Ephesus, which is pretty much on the coast, although it's got tilted up now, then Smyrna, then Pergamon, so three cities up the coast, basically. Then you go inland, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. So they're all in a little kind of circuit of about, 300 miles in the west coast of Turkey, or west coast of Asia Minor. Okay, so there's seven letters to the seven churches, and they all follow a similar pattern. Of basically praise and blame, and it more blame than you would like normally as a pastor to do, but basically each one of them says to the church that is in such and such a city. You can look at the first one to Ephesus, for example, right? The words of the one who holds the seven stars, this is Jesus, I know your works. Then it starts out with praise, and sadly the praise is that you hate the same people that I hate, so that's good. But the blame is that you've lost the love that you first had. Then there's a call for repentance. Remember the love that you had, come back. Let the one who has an ear hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. It's very interesting. This is in all the letters because these are words of Jesus. And then the last line, or somewhere in each of these letters, is a promise to the one who conquers, or to the one who is a Nike. To the one who is victorious, the person who conquers, I will give, and then there's a promise of something that God will give. So that's the one who conquers is meant to be us. If we are faithful, and if we take to heart the words of these letters, then we are going to be the conqueror, the Nike one. Which is very interesting that right here at the beginning of the book of Revelation, seven times then, is set up this idea of the Christian as understanding themselves as the conqueror. Which is unheard of in Roman theology. I mean, because the conqueror was the soldier or the emperor, the general, who led the military victory. But no, in the book of Revelation, what's set up already in these seven letters is the one who conquers, the Nike, is you. And you're led then through this book to want to be a conqueror. And it culminates in the final letter to Laodicea at the end of chapter 3, where you get two references. That's 3 verse 21. I've marked it there as twice. To the one who conquers, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, Jesus is saying, as I myself conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne. So here you get the first understanding that Jesus also has conquered. We are to be conquerors, or Nikes, and Jesus also is a victor. You could use that now if you want. And now you're being led through this story of Revelation. Okay, what does it mean that Jesus has conquered? And what does it mean that I'm to be a conqueror? What's the model of conquering? And then what you can do with the concordance to figure it out, to answer that question, what's the model of conquering here, is just begin to trace the references through. Okay, the next one you get is in chapter 5, and this is where you first meet the Lamb. I think in some ways this little section, chapter 5, verses 5 and 6, is the most important turning point. Surprise moment and identity moment in the book of Revelation. What you get in chapter 4 is you go up to the divine throne room. The voice from from heaven says, come up here and I will show you. And John goes up there. And by the way, Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins will argue that that's the rapture where John is going up to heaven. But it's not the rapture. I mean, it's only he going up, not... And it's not going up for 7 years. It's just going up to have a look around and then relay the vision. But you get this amazing heavenly throne room vision of God, who's the one seated on the throne. Around God is this are these rings of worshipers. One of the great things about Revelation, you've got animals worshiping God, so the living creatures. Think of your cat and dog. Actually, Dan Erlander has this other great quote. I didn't use it in my book, but I use this fluffy one. But I've heard Dan up here say, take the San Diego Zoo, which he thinks is the best zoo in the world. I don't know if he would still maintain that. Take the San Diego Zoo, take the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, whatever you think is the best choir in the world, St. Elf Choir, Luther, whatever. And then throw crowns around. And that's what you've got in this scene, up in the heavenly throne. All this worshiping going on. Animals, choruses, elders, clanking of crowns, It's an amazing worship scene that actually most scholars think is written specifically to trump any grandiose worship scene that might happen in Rome in the actual emperor's court. We're saying, John is basically saying, hey, we've got better worship going up in our heavenly throne room than you'll ever have in your palace and throne room. But anyway, the God who is seated on the throne is holding a scroll with seven seals on it. And the big question then is, who is worthy to open the scroll and to break the seals and open it? And the question is, in verse 5 here of chapter 5, then one of the, oh yeah, and oh, John, verse 4, sorry, John weeps that no one is found worthy. Then one of the elders said to me, weep not, for lo, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. So again, this word conquering, the Lion of the tribe of Judah is the one who has conquered. Okay, up to this point, this is, I didn't do my whole thing on apocalypses and what to expect, but basically, lots of apocalypses were written in the ancient world, Jewish apocalypses, other apocalypses. Lions are fairly typical. When something needs to be done, bring in a lion with sharp claws, a fierce lion, or an eagle, something with talons that will be able to scratch it open. So this is expected up to this point, but the big surprise in Revelation comes in the next verse. Between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain. And I think this is a key moment where you're set up to expect a lion, but what you get instead, very deliberately, and you're told moreover that the lion has conquered. So again, we're continuing the Nike theme. Conquering is what you would expect a lion to do, and suddenly, instead of the lion, what you get is the lamb. Jesus is not introduced as a lion of the tribe of Judah. He's introduced rather as this lamb. And the Greek word for lamb here is not even just the regular word for lamb like in the Gospel of John, which is omnos. It's the diminutive form, arnion, little lamb. That's why David calls this lamb fluffy. Or you could call it lambkin or whatever. I mean, it's completely unexpected. There is nothing else like this in all of Jewish apocalyptic literature. I mean, to introduce this lamb at this moment is a radical break with anything that's to be expected. And this, then, is the image for Jesus in the rest of the book of Revelation. These are all the references to lamb in the book of Revelation, 29 of them. I've written them all out here. The first one is right here in chapter 5, verse 6, completely unexpectedly. But after this, except for that moment in chapter 19 that the Left Behind novels love to fixate on, you know, the conquering Jesus who comes on a white horse with the sword in his mouth who slays his enemies. Other than that one appearance, the only way Jesus is described throughout the rest of the book of Revelation is as a lamb. Four times here in chapter 5, twice in chapter 6, and all throughout. I mean, it's incredible how this is the primary image for Jesus. Now, I would say the first thing about this is obviously that's a clue. I think that you can't read the book of Revelation literally because, you know, Jesus was not a sheep. Whatever else you want to think about Jesus, no one would say that he literally was a sheep. So this is obviously metaphorical language, but it's very wonderful metaphorical language. It's tapping into Old Testament traditions. I would say most strongly probably the Exodus tradition of how it's the blood of the lamb on the doorposts of the Israelites' houses that saved them. But the Isaiah 53 lamb who, you know, like a sheep was who was led to the slaughter and didn't resist, opened not his mouth, and by his blood we are healed. I mean, this idea of the sacrificial lamb who is not resisting being killed, but rather submits, and this is who Jesus is. And somehow, through having his blood shed, I mean, it's a lamb who has been slain, so this is the crucifixion, but now is standing. That's the resurrection. This, then, is the primary image for Jesus in the book of Revelation, this little lamb who bears on his body the wounds of having been slain, but yet is standing. Ahan, did you have a question?
I was wondering why you're acquainted with the Jesus scholars.
Yeah.
Why haven't the Old Testament scholars gotten together, or New Testament as well, and exposed the Left Behind series is the greatest hoax and heresy of all time?
Well, that's what I'm trying to do.
I appreciate that, but why haven't And why aren't preachers getting up and speaking about the addictive violence that you do so well? Because
well, hopefully you are. We just need to get on board. We've got to get going. I mean, I think in some ways we were asleep at the switch because they're just novels. You think, you know, I mean, oh, I can't waste my time as a Bible scholar critiquing novels, but now I realize I can. Because novels are more powerful in a way. Narrative captures our imagination, and we need to tell the story differently. I mean, I'm not a novel writer, but somebody needs to write a novel about land power, and I don't know what that is, but I mean, this now needs to... I go back to the old C.S. Lewis novels. The Chronicles of Narnia, I think, are far better Christian fiction than the Left Behind novels. I mean, at least there, Lucy and her companions, you know, it includes some animals. There's a love for creation. When they go into New Narnia, they realize it's the renewed world that they've been in all the time, so it's a kind of going more deeper into this world, not an escape from this world. I mean, but we need to do it. We absolutely need to do it, because this lamp, I mean, I'll tell you where the Left Behind novels completely ignore all these references to Jesus as the Lamb, except for one. And this is the subject of an entire book. Chapter 6, verse 16. Is there one reference to the Lamb that they like? Why do they like this one out of the 29 references? Well, because this is the wrath of the Lamb. This is the only place in the book of Revelation where the Lamb has anything to do with wrath. And notice, this is when the sixth seal has been opened, and people are really scared because all these earthquakes and stuff are happening. And they're fleeing. People are fleeing. Under mountains and rocks, they're saying, fall on us and hide us from the face of the one who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. But never does the narrator of the book of Revelation talk about the wrath of the Lamb. There's no other reference to the wrath of the Lamb. It's only people who are trying to flee that say, you know, no, no, there's the wrath of the Lamb. But that becomes then a centerpiece of the Left Behind novels, is this thing called the Wrath of the Lamb earthquake that happens over the whole world except for Israel. Many people are killed. Our hero, Rayford Steele, always manages to escape these apocalyptic disasters because he's a pilot, and he just happens to be in the air flying his plane whenever anything strikes the earth, so he stays alive. But otherwise, you know, these novels are going to kill off 3/4 of the world's population before they're done. Many, many people are killed, and a lot of them get taken care of right here in the Wrath of the Lamb earthquake, according to Left Behind. But the Left Behind novels never get to the New Jerusalem vision that I think the whole book is leading up to. And the image of the Lamb there, they skip over whole central elements of the book of Revelation. And I think you can legitimately say, you know, okay, there's competing images for Jesus in the book of Revelation. That's the problem. I'll grant you that. And the warrior Jesus is there. There's no question that what he's there in chapter 19, but that's one reference. There's 29 others that have the Lamb. So how do you decide, you know, which image of Jesus is truly the image of Jesus in the book of Revelation? You know, and what does the conquering Messiah mean? Well, obviously some people will not be persuaded. But you have to go with sort of the weight of the evidence. And what's this author trying to help us see about Jesus and about conquering? Okay.
Can I ask a question quick?
Sure.
In the Greek, back in chapter 5, verse 6, the land of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed. Is that, what kind of verb is that in the Greek?
Perfect. Let me see. I gotta find it here. Yep, and Nikkei said, no, it's just simply aorist, but it's past. Yeah, and that's an important one because the victory happened, the conquering happened in Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. The victory has already happened. That's the other striking thing about the book of Revelation is in chapter 19, even when this so-called avenging warrior Jesus comes back, there's no battle that happens there. And actually, it's been Mennonite scholars who have been the best at pointing this out to us. Yoder has a little bit in his book, but now a guy named... Griffith. What is his first name? I cite him in
Lee.
Here. Lee Griffith. And then I have another book by a guy named Lauren Johns, who is dean of the Mennonite Seminary in Goshen, Indiana, called The Lamb Christology of the Apocalypse of John. He makes this case very powerfully that no battle happens in chapter 19 because in the theology of Revelation, the victory, the Nike, the true victory has already happened in Jesus' death. It's the Lamb who has been slain in the past and now is standing, who already won the victory. And it's not a future battle of Armageddon that has to decide the future of the planet. No, the future of the planet has already been decided. The victory has already been won in Jesus' death and resurrection. So it's past tense. Thanks for pointing that out. All right, then The question becomes, though, what I want to look at with you the rest of the time is what does our victory look like? Because we see here that the Lamb has conquered, but where do we find out what our conquering, our Nike, looks like? And is it a conquering with military weapons, like in the Left Behind novels? I mean, you're all supposed to go out and get your latest directed energy weapons and your Uzis. Everybody in the Left Behind novels carries guns. It's amazing. They've all got multiple guns. Even Chloe, Rayford Steele's daughter, has a Luger, which I guess is an old German gun or something. But anyway, I mean, they're all carrying guns all the time. So we have to ask, is that what our model of conquering is? I mean, here's where we're set up to be expecting to be conquerors. In chapter 21 also, it tells that the one who conquers will inherit these things, which is us. So what's our conquering going to look like? How do we understand it? Well, we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to skip over some of these. But let's take a look at chapter 11, because I would say this is the key verse where it's laid out. Part of the dilemma is that both bad guys and good guys conquer in Revelation. I mean, it's a mythic kind of imagery. So here in chapter 6, this is where you get the four horses coming out, you know, the Notre Dame backfield. The four horses that are, you know, death, plague, and they're each a different color and stuff. The fourth and most deadly of the horses comes out conquering and to conquer. So that's, I would say, an image of Rome's conquering, Rome's conquest. So you've got in Revelation the story of competing models of conquering. The beast is the Roman Empire, and the beast can conquer. I mean, that's what the Arch of Titus reminds us, everything that Rome had tremendous power to conquer. And you've always got these competing images of conquering, the violence of Rome's military conquering versus the Lamb's conquering that is different. But that's, I think, the model that we are to follow, and you see that most clearly in chapter 11. I think I put the wrong verse number up there. I think it's 11:17. At least I don't see 11:7. Mm-hmm. No? Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I think my concordance failed me or I wrote it wrong. Just a second. Oh, it's 12. 12:11. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, 12:11. I'm in the wrong chapter. Pardon me. Let's go to this one. Yeah. They're both there. Yeah, 11:7 is the meat. Okay, 12:11. Because this is where we learn. Chapter 12 is the central chapter of Revelation, and this is in some ways the most mythical. This is where you see this war that takes place up in heaven, where it's mythic. I mean, it's not literal, obviously, but Satan gets thrown out of heaven and down to earth. So after this, things get worse on earth. The bad stuff intensifies because Satan is temporarily stalking us on earth. But nonetheless, here, in the heart of this mythic sort of battle, comes the message of how we are to conquer, and comes praise of God. I mean, even in the midst of terrible stuff in Revelation, you always get these heavenly choruses breaking out. So in verse 10, I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation, the power, the kingdom of our God, the authority of Christ have come. So that also is past tense, or perfect. It's already happened, for the accuser of our brothers and sisters has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. But they have conquered him. I mean, this is the interesting thing. Satan has been thrown out of heaven. He's now stalking us on earth. And already Revelation can say, but they have conquered him. That's us. We have already conquered Satan, according to Revelation. And how do we do it? Two ways. Number one, by the blood of the Lamb. And number two, by the word of our testimony. For they love not their lives even unto death. This is how people conquer in the book of Revelation. We don't join in the armies of that avenging warrior Jesus in chapter 19. There's an army that follows him, but it's an army from heaven. It's not us. Where Revelation tells us most clearly what our role is as conquerors and how we are to become Nikes or victors is right here in chapter 12, verse 11. We conquer in two ways. Number one, by the blood of the Lamb. And that's another central question is, what does this mean, the blood of the Lamb? For the Left Behind novels, it's the blood that the Lamb sheds, other people's blood. And there's blood all through these novels. I mean, it just flows through these novels. There's a passage in chapter 19, it's 16, I'm sorry, I goofed up here. One of their favorite ones where they can hardly wait for the Battle of Armageddon because blood will flow up to the horses' bridles.
in the land of Israel, they say blood will be so deep, you know, it's going to be like 4 or 5 feet deep, and that's they're craving this level of blood and gore. But in Revelation, that is not what the blood of the Lamb is about. Rather, the blood of the Lamb is the Lamb's own blood that was shed in Jesus' crucifixion. So we now become conquerors in chapter 12, verse 11, by being partners with Jesus, or being found in the blood of the Lamb, that is, by following him wherever he leads. And that's the vision in chapter 14 of just simply following the Lamb. This is us who are followers of the Lamb, who stands on Mount Zion. Wherever he goes, we are to go. So we follow him and embrace the blood of the Lamb, not the blood that he sheds, not other people's blood, but his own blood. And then the second part is perhaps even more important, by the word of our testimony. This book believes that you can face down Roman imperial conquering power, all the violence of Rome, which everybody knew. They had seen these captives dragged through the streets. They had seen them slaughtered. They knew that that's what Rome's version of conquering is. And yet John has the guts to say, you can conquer that by the word of your testimony.
Barb, one of the things that's striking me now is how incredibly radical the gathering for the Eucharist is. When you say, worthy is Christ, the Lamb who is slain, it's just, what have you been saying all this time? It's just...
Yeah, the blood of the Lamb, yeah. And it's a different model. It's victory. Yeah, that's straight out of the book of Revelation. This is the Feast of Victory for our God. It's from Revelation 5. It's radical. And John, I mean, he's just this little person writing to probably 30, 40 Christians, telling them that you can conquer Rome and empire by the word of your testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. And that's what true conquering is. That's what true Nike is. It's Lamb power. So, let's talk about it. I mean, how do we do it now? That's our friend here posed a question earlier. Why haven't we been teaching this? You know, now's the time to start. It's never too late. We are facing down empire once again. And we have, moreover, another challenge, which is that the version of Christianity that has taken over in our churches and our world is the violent version of Christianity. I have a chapter in here that I call Hijacking the Lamb, because I think the Lamb has been hijacked by this left-behind kind of theology that says, they go back to chapter 5 and they say, okay, the first time Jesus came, it was as the Lamb. But the second time Jesus is going to come, it's going to be the avenging lion. He's going to kick butt. You know, it's going to be a serious Jesus. It's, you know, he's going to slay his enemies. So they think Jesus didn't really finish the job the first time, that he's got to come back a second time now as the lion. But again, you read through Revelation, you could look up the word lion, same thing. It's the Greek word leon. There's no indication that this author ever wants Jesus to come back as a lion. The only time he envisions Jesus as a lion is in setting us up for the unexpected lamb, and he never comes back in any positive way to lions. Lions are always negative after that. Jesus is the lamb in the book of Revelation, and we need then to think about, what does that mean for our world today? How do we go about living out lamb power? This verse, chapter 12, verse 11, of conquering empire and violence and evil. The beast. I mean, Revelation calls it very clearly the beast. Right here in chapter 12, it's Satan who has been thrown out of heaven and is now stalking our world, and yet he has the audacity to say that Christians have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. What does that look like for us?
It seems to me, Barbara, that in order to use your witness, to your words to testify, as is the second part of that, you need that lion in you to speak out. And, you know, someone was saying, why haven't we done something? Well, it's because people are afraid to speak out. I did a prayer last Sunday, and it took guts to name our nation as arrogant. I mean, how do you do that in front of people except by being a lion? You be a lion in order to be a lamb. You know, it's you need both in order to be.
It's not when
people are afraid to speak out.
Mm-hmm. Here's a small example. A friend that I know, when she shops, goes to the manager and says, "I don't like these shirts that you're selling for my daughter. Give me your corporate number." She calls the corporate number and says, "The messages on these t-shirts for young girls are not okay. I'm not going to shop at your store." That's a small thing. It does take chutzpah, or whatever you want to call it. It takes strength. And you do have to speak out and stick your neck out.
Yeah, it takes the strength of a lion. But yeah, and the, what I like about the idea of the lamb is it's so kind of winsome and funny. I mean, if we had t-shirts, you know, that it were lamb power, this funny lamb flexing his muscles, I mean, it's almost sort of disarming to think about a lamb being able to conquer empire. As I was writing the book, I ran across this one by a British Methodist woman that I mostly like for the cover picture. It's called Following the Lamb, a reading of Revelation for the New Millennium, and she's got a picture of a lamb standing in a shopping mall. You know, at the foot of the escalator, there's a lamb standing there. We had some friends in Wenatchee who raised lambs, so I went up to visit these lambs, you know, and you just learn about lambs, and they're kind of funny and stuff. I mean, they're goofy, and but this, you know, so it's a very sort of winsome image, that, and why the author of Revelation would choose this, and what it's going to mean for us to take it seriously. I think that's a serious question. Where I got the word from is this book by a guy named Ward Ewing, who's president now of General Theological Seminary in New York City. He's an Episcopal priest and president of the seminary, and he's the one who develops this notion of lamb power as the power of God's non-violent love to transform the world. And our non-violent as well is the most powerful force in the world for transformation, he argues. And he was only, you know, 2 or 3 miles from Ground Zero on September 11th. And he would argue that even more forcefully now. I've heard him speak since then on Revelation. More and more, he believes that only lamb power can save us. Not the power of greater violence, not the power of, you know, military. Because we're currently in a situation where we're going to be in endless war. The war on terrorism, you'll just, you know, you conquer one country, Iraq, whatever, you just go on to the next. This is a war that, by definition, will never be over. Is this what the message of the gospel is? No. Ward Ewing would say no. Even more so, he will say, after September 11th, we need lamb power, and Christians need to be about that.
Barb, yesterday you implied something. I don't know that everybody here was here, and it was that people need to be educated as to what you're talking about now. In other words, that you said something like some pastors will be confronted by their congregation saying, what about this? Isn't this true? Well, I guess it is. You know, I mean, they kind of need to be educated that no, that's not what Revelation really says.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, no, again, you can find that avenging warrior Jesus in Revelation once. But you got 29 references to lambs. So on the one hand, yes, a parishioner can come to you and say, well, look, there is the warrior Jesus, of course. But the only way you can counter is to say, well, yes, but the dominant image of Revelation. But, you know, again, there's all these images for Jesus in the Bible, but we need to then decide consciously what's the heart of the Bible, which image of the many are we going to embrace as the main image for Jesus. Uh-huh.
You're making the point that Jesus is a savior, not a warrior, right?
Right.
Now, what did Martin Luther say and what did Joseph Sittler say about Revelation on this point? Because they're, you know, well-known theologians over the time. Luther, of course.
I don't think Sittler wrote on Revelation. Well, Martin Luther, I would say, is somewhat problematic on the book of Revelation. The first time he wrote about it, he said, if you want to look at Luther's works, volume 35 in there, that's where you see his prefaces to the various books of the New Testament. And at the end are his two prefaces to Revelation. The first time he said, my spirit cannot accommodate itself to this book. I don't see Christ preach, you know. He threw it in the same category as James,
yep.
You know, an epistle of
struck. He would have had it out of the canon, wouldn't he?
Well, that was his first preface, but the second one, I think, is equally problematic, but in the other direction. In his second preface, he realized by that time that Revelation is a really good book for vilifying your enemies. Because you simply identify all of them with the various beasts and locusts and critters of Revelation. You know, so he has Thomas Münzer be one of the locusts. The Roman Catholic Church, of course, is the whore of Babylon and the beast. And, you know, I mean, so, but he names his enemies, the Turks, the Muslims, are, so, you know, that's not how to use Revelation to vilify people, although that certainly the Left Behind theology teaches that. So I would say Luther is not your best person to use for Revelation. But there is a lot of great scholarship being done right now in Revelation. One of my favorites is, I think we have to look outside North America because some of the best stuff is being done. This is a Chilean scholar named Pablo Richard. This book I use with my students is called Apocalypse, a People's Commentary on the Book of Revelation, published by Orbis, translated from Spanish, and he's a Latin American liberation priest. Other stuff too.
Hey, Barb, how he talks about resistance and heat footing.
Oh, yeah. The,
that builds on what Kristen was talking about.
Yeah, the Greek word in that, throughout Revelation, trying to figure out our role, one of the things that John says in chapter 1, verse 9, he says, I know your tribulation, your, I've got to find chapter 1, verse 9. Anyway, oh, here it is, 1:9. I, John, your brother, who share with you in Jesus the tribulation, this is the Greek word philipsis, and the kingdom, or the empire, that's the Greek word basileia. Let's translate as empire. And then the third word here is hupomone, which is usually translated as patient endurance or something like that. But Pablo Richard suggests that we translate it as resistance. That again, what we're supposed to be about as Christians is hupomone, which is like patient resistance. But it's not just passive resistance. It's an endurance that that resists empire, and I think Pablo Richard is very good on that. Thanks, Lauren, for pointing that out. But others on Lampower, how are you going to do it, Bob?
I'm just going to say, I think as you've been talking the last 2 days, there's a level here where it strikes me that the left behind philosophy is kind of the easy way out with Jesus. I mean, it's easy to say I accept Jesus as my personal savior and I'll be raptured, rather than coming to a place like this and finding out that Jesus, we know about is hard. It's a lot harder than that. It has to do with distribution of wealth, taking care of the poor, being nonviolent. That kind of stuff has to constantly be learned and relearned. I mean, that's why we keep coming back here all the time. It's hard, and it's a harder brand. It's a harder brand of Jesus that I don't think our public. I think on one level we want the easy way out. We'd rather take pills and exercise. We'd rather, that's why it's so appealing, I think. Mm-hmm.
It's hard, and yet it's winsome. That's also why we're here, because we've been captured by the fun of it, the joy of it in some ways, too. And I think, you know, take this image with you. I think the only way we can do it, just start thinking every moment now after, well, even while you're in holding, you know, how would I live differently if there was a little lamb under that tree, or, you know, a fawn, or whatever, you know, up here could be fawn power, but, or I'm trying to think about, you know, now when I'm driving in traffic, you know, how would I drive differently if I had a lamb next to me? And this is what the Lemoinian book, I think, is so good for, is just start thinking that, because this is what Revelation wants to say to you, is you do have the lamb beside you at every moment. You have Jesus with you. And for whatever strange reason, Revelation envisions Jesus, who is with you, as this little lamb, a disarming Arnion, fluffy lamb, who is with you at every moment, and you are now to be a follower of the lamb. That's the vision of chapter 14. The Christians who follow Jesus are those who follow the lamb. And it's almost like that nursery rhyme, Mary had a little lamb. You know, everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. It followed her to school one day, you know, made the children laugh and play, whatever. We are meant now to be like that, to be people who follow the lamb wherever it goes, and to find the lamb leading us around our world, around our city, around our neighborhood, to see the world differently in light of lamb power. And it's hard.
It's hard.
And yet it's this winsome lamb who's tenderly shepherding us through whatever is coming.
I think we do it in community. And I'm thinking about lambs. I've been around them, and they are just kind of fun. You know, they just hang out. They do their thing. And there's a real strong sense of being, not so much doing. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do anything as Christians, but I'm saying that sometimes our greatest doing comes out of our being and being grounded in that being. And I think that as believers, when we live in community and we can support each other in our individual beings, who we are, and support those giftings, that becomes very winsome to the world, to be a part of a community where you can be who you were created to be and have people support that around you. I think that does become very winsome to the world. So I think that we become winsome by living in community.
Huh, and it's an irresistible kind of love. Okay, Chuck, you had your hand up, but then Hudson, then Kristen, and then Libby. Then we have to go to coffee break.
The Gospels give us the imagery also of the Lamb of God fairly centrally at the point of the crucifixion.
The Gospel of John. Yeah.
Based on Hebrew scripture material, I guess, and drawing from that, Does it also, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, the Lamb of God whose blood covers the sin of humankind, does it have the image there also of victor? The Lamb as victor?
Well, the word victor or Nike isn't used right there in John, but yeah, I think that's the same understanding, exactly. Uh-huh. But nowhere except Revelation connects the two in this conscious victor or Nike way. Uh-huh. Okay, Hans.
Barb, what I'm wondering about is which qualities of the Lamb, which is a metaphor, we want to transfer to Jesus, and which qualities we need to, let's say, screen out. I think one of the tricky things about metaphor is thinking, you're leading me to think about which qualities of the Lamb do we want to screen out. There's some really cute ones that you're mentioning. And I'm inclined to think that if you think of this as a theological statement, that the image of the Lamb points to God's self-giving profoundly. And so then the question is, some people have raised already, what about the strength that you need to have to withstand?
That was Kristen's question.
Which is so good. And
well, that's why it's Lamb power. You absolutely need strength.
Uh-huh. Right, and I think it's helpful, since you mentioned C.S. Lewis, that the person who sacrifices himself for Narnia is Aslan.
Who's a lion, yeah. Uh-huh.
So my thought now goes on to say there are other metaphors, mm-hmm. and how can we link those metaphors to power once we've seen that fighting with military power is not the way to fight. What other metaphors are useful to flesh out the strength that you're looking for in the word power?
Yeah. Good.
Are there others in
Well, and that might, well, it might be that in chapter 5, verse 6, the lamb doesn't completely replace the lion, but that, as Kristen said also, that you need both, but they play off against each other, and that the lionness of Aslan is the sense of power. Kristen?
The word winsome bothers me, because we are all trained to be winsome to each other. And I totally agree with what Hans is saying, that pulling out the qualities of the lamb is really important. It's not good enough. It's not good enough to be winsome. What we have to be winsome with. I mean, righteous anger has a place.
Maybe disarming, is that better?
I don't know. But you know, if you can fit it into what Dan was talking about last week with justice, shalom, and
surprise. Yeah, the element of surprise.
Righteousness, justice, and loving kindness. You know, pulling those qualities out and being angry, that's the lion aspect. I'm angry that we can't, that we're not in a righteous relationship and that we don't have shalom.
All right, Libby, you get the last word. Then we're going to coffee.
Well, I have a friend at home who reminds me that we belong to the Evangelical Lutheran Church, and I always want her to stop talking there because evangelical carries such a negative weight for me. But once when we were talking at great length about that, she disarmed me. That's the word that I have to use, because she said, Elizabeth, finally, I just want people to know the mercy of Christ. She wasn't worried about personal savior or individual salvation. We just want people to know the mercy of Christ. That's our testimony.
Yeah, and we have to be willing to evangelize. For Lamb Power. We are evangelical, so go and proclaim. All right.